Good morning, everyone. Let me just pour myself a little bit of water. So I was putting my phone in airplane mode before I came up here, and I realized that it didn't turn off the Bluetooth connection, which I think is a convenience of iOS 12. And that's actually good, because that means my Fitbit can continue to talk to my phone while I'm talking to you, which tells us something about the subtlety of the radio spectrum in 2018, because that phrase would have seemed even inconceivable back in 2008. Now, I want to give you, James went into it, I want to give you a little bit of my bona fides about why I'm actually really excited to be able to address you this morning. So this is a bit of a recap of my career. So in 1984, so about 35 years ago, I was writing firmware for X25 packet assembler disassemblers. Who here remembers X25? Bless you all. We all have gray hair now. And then I was writing firmware for CSU DSUs. Who remembers those? All the telecoms people, thank you, exactly. And then I was working for a company that pioneered dial-up networking, Shiva Corporation. You could, from your Macintosh at home, you could dial up to the home network and use the servers and print things. It was magical. And then I got the opportunity to work with Tim Berners-Lee. I'm one of the folks who helped bring you the World Wide Web. We apologize. That was so that I could take my work in 3D interfaces and in VR and bring that onto the web with VRML, which I then took through the standards process, first through ISO, and again, people get less time for murder. And then it became part of MPEG. MPEG Layer 4, Part 11, is a compositing layer, a 3D layer, rarely used but still present, that uses VRML as the 3D compositing layer on MPEG. Then I was asked to found new media programs at USC and at Afters, because once we had created all these great media tools, it was important to train a generation of professionals to be able to use and profit from the use of those tools. Most recently, I've been working on a new set of protocols that will be used in augmented reality and autonomous systems. We'll come to that a little bit further along in our talk. Now, all of that is my history. I had a brief run-in with an obscure politician in 2011 who didn't know any of this. I'd like to play that.
This is actually provable that we needed what we needed maybe 64 kilobits for back in 1995. We now need 6 megabits for in 2011, and we will need 60 megabits for in 2016 or 2018. I mean, this is chartable. We know this. And unless we can bring that into the household reliably, by around 2020, we're going to be strangling ourselves with our own broadband cord.
Well, it's, can I just say that, you know, truthfully, I mean, you've got to sort of lay off the cool air for this and get fairly good about it.
I went to Tokyo on holidays, and I'm walking around in Akihabara, the electronics district, as you do if you're a geek in Tokyo, and I come across this. Translated, that means satellite broadcasting of 8K is going to begin on the 1st of December in Japan. So we're already here. We're already in this era of needing extremely high bandwidth for extremely high bandwidth broadcast-based applications. And you know, everyone in this room will be familiar with 8K, because it's essentially four 4K streams. So it provides an 8K image. Now, NHK is pioneering this, as they have with every generation of high-definition television, because they themselves are preparing to broadcast the Tokyo Olympics in 8K. And they will have a completely realized broadcast infrastructure in place and well-tested by August of 2020, when they actually start the broadcast. So they're being absolutely methodical about their progression into 8K, and we're actually now starting to see the first generation of 8K television sets. When I go to the Consumer Electronics Show in January, I think that's probably going to be the great big thing. But of course, 8K is bandwidth hungry. NHK predicts that a good 8K channel, now this is before Netflix has done their magic on it, but a good 8K channel will require 85 megabits. And that means that we have an approaching problem, because on the one side, you now have the release of these 8K devices, and on the other side, the growing realization that the bandwidth infrastructure that we have, because of the shadow communications minister who then became the communications minister, who then became the prime minister, has left us somewhat lacking. And so now we're about to see ourselves being left behind in an entire generation unless we actually bite the bullet and go through a massive and very rapid generational upgrade in our network capacities to be able to handle the next generation. Now, the next generation is not simply about putting more pixels on a screen, because people go, my gosh, with 4K, it's perfect. You can't get any more. More pixels is simply more pixels. Why would that matter? But there's a new emerging class of applications. And if you go back, that conversation with Malcolm is on YouTube. You can hear me say, we don't know the applications that are coming. We can only know that they're coming. And the applications that we couldn't know that were coming, the first of these are fully immersive applications. 8K is not something that you see on a screen. 8K is something that you see fully around you, whether that's in a virtual reality system or in a display system that is placing you right in the middle of a scene that is unfolding all around you. This is the next place television broadcasting is going. It's immersion in a different sense than we're familiar with. It's immersion that is not just in front of a static screen. It is immersion that allows you to have a point of view, that allows you to focus on multiple things that are happening in a scene simultaneously. These systems are already being worked on. A few of them are sort of in testing and deployment. By 2020, by the time of the Tokyo Olympics, we will have some form of realistic, fully immersive 8K delivery. It's probably not going to be widespread yet, but we will be using that as the basic test to see how these systems will be used by the public in the future. That is just the tip of the iceberg that represents the transformation of television broadcasting as we know it. Because all of this is played out on a flat screen. What you're getting is a very immersive but flat view. The next place we're going is a technology known as videogrammetry. Videogrammetry is based on some technology that was developed in the early 1990s, which allows you to take a whole bunch of photographs of something from a whole bunch of different angles, hand that off to a computer that calculates the angles, abstracts from that the 3D geometry, and produces a fully realized 3D model. Now, this is a computationally expensive process. It requires a lot of computing, particularly at the time it was done. You could take these photos, give them to a computer for a day, and then you would get a model back. You can now do these systems in more or less real time. How many of you own an iPhone 10? Every time you use Face ID on an iPhone 10, it is doing photogrammetry, because it is casting an infrared dot model onto your face, it is doing a depth map, it is producing a 3D model from that, and then measuring that against the model that's stored in your phone so that you can actually realize, fully realize 3D models in real time from a camera perspective. So videogrammetry now represents a new kind of fidelity in broadcasting. There have been a bunch of people who have been working on this for several years. One of the most outstanding demos of this, and one of the first modern demos of this, came from Microsoft 2.5 years ago. I'm going to show you just a section of this. He'll talk a little bit about the technology, but what I want you to see is the technology in use, because this shows you not just where television is going, but where the telephone is going. Oh, wait a second. I'm out of order. I'm sorry. When we start using these devices, when we start using videogrammetry, we won't be doing this inside of virtual reality systems, we won't be doing this in front of screens. We'll be doing this in a new class of devices which produce augmented reality. And we're starting to see the first of these devices. How many of you have seen or used a Microsoft HoloLens? So HoloLens is the first class of these devices. If you haven't used a HoloLens, go and use a HoloLens, because you have to understand the experience of the mixture of the real world and the synthetic world, because that's what these devices do. And this mix is effectively seamless because these devices are continuously scanning the world around you so that you can situate the real world and the virtual world in a way that makes sense to you. So you don't get these weird, you don't have things interpenetrating walls or other objects or where other people are, but you have these fully realized systems. Now, the HoloLens is essentially an experiment by Microsoft. They'll be releasing another one in January or February this year. The device that you just saw is Magic Leap. How many of you have heard of Magic Leap? Magic Leap is the best funded startup in history. They have received $3 billion in venture capital from the likes of Google and SoftBank and Alibaba. Why? Because they're producing the device that it is widely believed will come to rival, if not replace, the smartphone as our interface to the data world over the next generation. So that about 10 years from now, you will see people in public wearing things that look like expensive pairs of sunglasses that will actually be immersing them in this mixture of the real and the virtual world. Okay. Now I've explained the use of these devices, let's see the use case that Microsoft came up with 2.5 years ago.
Now, to make all this happen, we've had to create a new type of 3D capture technology. I'm surrounded by these 3D cameras that we've developed in our team. Each of them is capturing me from a separate viewpoint, and we're fusing this data together to create a temporally consistent model, as you can see reconstructed live behind me. Now, the camera that's filming me as a HoloLens tracking system attached. And this allows us to take these 3D models and composite them in real time into the real world, as you can see here. And that gives you a sense of the fidelity of the reconstructions that we can achieve. Once we have these reconstructions, we can texture them, we can then compress the data and transmit the data over to the other side. Over on the other side, a user wearing a HoloLens can see these remote participants live in their space as if they're co-present. And that's what we're showing you picture in picture. Now imagine using this type of capture technology to connect with family members who are thousands of miles away. And that's exactly what we're going to demonstrate to you right now. My daughter is stood in a similar capture rig somewhere else in our lab. And she's going to teleport into my space, and I'm going to interact with her wearing my HoloLens. Hey, Lily, I miss you too.
You're coming home.
I'm coming home very soon. Let me get out of your way.
That's 2.5 years ago, and that technology has been carried forward. That technology required an entire room full of expensive computers. It can now be done in real time. Still requires a fairly large amount of computing, but what you're going to see over the next 5, 6, 7 years is that this technology will become more and more realizable. At least one mobile phone maker has already announced they're going to be using a face scanner that is built into their own smartphone, so similar to what's already in the iPhone X, to be able to do this as a conversational real-time tool requiring 5G networks. So what we're seeing now is an advance into the next kind of rich communication. So it's not just audio, it's not just video, but we're now talking about fully realized 3D worlds that are being captured in real time by devices and transmitted somewhere else. So this is the promise of videogrammetry. There's an enormous amount of work, an enormous amount of money that's going behind this. And we don't do so badly here in Australia. This is Humense. This is a company that's located up in the North Shore. They're also working. That's their capture facility. They're also working on this problem because there's going to be a lot of benefits that accrue to the companies that solve this problem for a number of reasons. They'll have an inside track on the technologies. They'll have an inside track on the patents. And you can imagine this patent pool will rival the MPEG patent pool in terms of its value. They will also have an inside track on the production techniques that will produce this next generation of technologies. Now, I think the part of this tape that's the most interesting, there's a part that's coming up just at the end, which shows how they're using it to capture sport. And to my mind, this is the key application for videogrammetry that will bring it home as a broadcasting technology. Now, they're only using one camera there, and I think that that's an interesting way to do it, but it doesn't give you the kind of fidelity you're going to need. But if you use a single camera, you can now put yourself anywhere you want on the playing field as far as that camera's point of view could do. But what happens if you start to use more and more cameras and you start to get more and more coverage of a scene? This means that someone who is now viewing an event can have an arbitrary point of view to that event. So it's very easy to imagine that, say, in about 5 years, the Australian Open, the Rod Laver Arena, with about 80 cameras statically rearranged around this, delivering a stream that allows viewers anywhere in the world to put themselves anywhere they want on the stands or on the court in real time, because the signal that's being transmitted has that level of fidelity associated with it. This is where television is evolving. This is where broadcast is evolving, because it's the first thing that's actually got enough extra associated with it to get people to migrate to a new set of technologies and interactions and expectations for the medium. And then about sort of 5 years after that, we're probably going to be good enough to be able to do something such as covering the AFL Grand Final. That will probably require 800 cameras, some of which will probably be sitting up on drones, directed from an artificial intelligence, which is doing its best to get coverage over the interesting areas on the match field, all integrated and then all streamed down to a viewer. Now, that data stream is not going to be small. It's probably going to make 8K television seem relatively modest, because it's going to be an enormous synthesis of three-dimensional data being streamed in real time. It lends itself to broadcasting, because you really don't want to take a terrestrial broadband network and send the stream out to everyone for something like this. So it lends itself to broadcasting if we can have the proper pieces in place at that time to create a foundation for broadcasting. Now, this is where Australia has a really unique opportunity to excel, because it is widely recognized that our sports broadcasting coverage in Australia is essentially without peer in the world. Yes, sure, the Americans do it just as well, but they only do it just as well. We actually have an opportunity to take our enormous experience and start to move it forward into the next generation of media. But we're going to have to be very busy inventing a whole bunch of new things to make this happen. We have cameras, but they're in very early stages. We don't really have anything like production facilities for this medium. We don't have production techniques or camera control or editing or sound. We don't have broadcast standards and codecs for this. And there's going to be that very interesting interplay between commercial organizations who are going to seek to patent and control these broadcast standards and the need for regulation and regulated standards for transmission around this. Now, we've seen television start to become this very mutable form where you can take a transport stream and then use a whole bunch of different codecs on that transport stream. It may very well be that we simply will need a new generation of codecs that will work on existing transport streams, but this is an area where Australia can start to establish leadership, put some flags in the ground, start to create the space, not just for the inventors of this technology to get together, but for the nations that will be using this as a broadcast medium to get together and collaborate on this new generation of videogrammetry broadcasting standards. And of course, this will also lead to a new generation of broadcast and design tools. So there's an opportunity for a whole new set of industries to be able to grow up, because essentially everything we've done with television, we will reinvent again. And we can have a frontline seat at that if we position ourselves correctly. And of course, all new advertising techniques, new advertisers, new agencies to deliver all of that advertising. All of this will unfold over the next 10 years as videogrammetry becomes a more and more and more common medium. And of course, it will exist in broadband first, it will exist in person-to-person communication first, but it will start to tip over into a more broadcast space from a broadband space. Okay. That's broadcasting sorted. Let's cover the other half of the equation here, because broadcasting is going to drive both broadband and spectrum in a very specific, very heavy, intense direction. That's a good thing. We need to encourage that. We need to lean into it. We need to design for it. We need to plan for it. But there's this other thing that's happening at the same time, autonomy. And autonomy, to me, is at least as exciting, maybe more exciting, than everything that is going on in broadcasting right now. And of course, when we think of autonomy, the first image that comes to most people's minds is a self-driving Tesla. We hold that up as, oh, that's autonomy. That's the future. That's what autonomy means. We're going to have a very wide range of autonomous vehicles. And autonomous automobiles will be driving a lot of the needs for autonomy. But what I really want to do is I want to show you that the field for what we consider autonomy is much, much broader than the considerations for autonomous automobiles. And I need to do this by telling a story which is going to poke a hole in the whole idea of the autonomous car. So the CEO of Mercedes-Benz has promised that you're going to have a self-driving car by 2021, and of course he's been building cars for a while, but you know what? He's not a computer scientist and he's not a roboticist. And if you ask either of them, will we have self-driving cars in 2021, they go, no. Why? I'm going to tell you a story. So I don't live very far from here. I live over in Chippendale, and I was giving a talk at Sydney Town Hall. This was back, I think, in March. And I had my suit on, and I would normally walk, because it's a 20-minute walk, but I had my suit on, it was a hot day, I was like, okay, I'm gonna take a taxi. Call a taxi, taxi pulls up. I say, all right, mate, need to go to town hall. He goes, huh. And I sat there for a minute and went, huh. He'd been driving a taxi in Sydney for 20 years. I've lived in Sydney for 15 years, and both of us are like, huh. And the reason we're huh is because there's this little thing called George Street in the way. Otherwise known as the project that will never end. It took both of us racking our brains to figure out how to go what used to be a straight shot down George Street from my house, because you couldn't. And so we went down Wattle Street, and then we went over Goulburn Street, and then we got to George Street, and can we turn here? And then we basically did dead reckoning navigation. We got to the next navigable point and then looked at that navigable point and said, okay, how do we get there from here? Again, 35 years combined experience in Sydney, and it was taxing both of us. An autonomous vehicle would have had a nervous breakdown long before that. And so we have to understand that autonomy works really well where the decision level is low. Yesterday, and it was on the ABC, yesterday they tested autonomous vehicles in downtown Adelaide, which is just about the perfect city for it since the streets are wide enough that you can turn a six oxen cart around, right? We all know this about Adelaide. They closed off the streets because God forbid there should be traffic, and then they tested the self-driving cars. That is the ideal environment. I'm sure that the cars worked well. Now let's put one of those cars on Pitt Street, or God forbid, on George Street, and let's see how far it can go before essentially the operating system resigns and just hopefully pulls itself over to the side and has a quiet cry. Because that's what we're asking these autonomous systems to do. So the first thing that we need to understand about autonomy is only as good as our ability with computer science. And we're not bad, but we are not magicians. And so autonomy works well where we can manage the number of decisions that are being made. So on the highway, for example, as long as there's no heavy rain or heavy wind or heavy fog, then the car can drive itself. And we'll probably have interstate trucks over the next 5 years that are perfectly capable of starting driving themselves when they get to Liverpool and stopping driving themselves when they get to Tullamarine, because it's a straight shot between those two and the decision level is fairly low. But when they start to come onto the city roads with city traffic and lots of unpredictable people and lots of changing situations, this is where we start to see a boundary where human safety and machine intelligence are going to start to have a bit more of a conversation. And so when we think about building for autonomy, and particularly autonomous vehicles, autonomy is something that's going to proceed from the outside in, which is the reverse of the way we're building our networks. And that's the first thing I wanted to point out, that in fact, autonomous systems will require the greatest support first in least dense areas, because that is where they're going to be effective first. And so that means that 5G networks, which will be supporting these systems, will need to be very capable in areas where they have low density, because that is where autonomous systems are going to be making the greatest demands on them immediately. And I know we're probably going to be building our 5G systems from the center of the cities on out, because we tend to do that, because it makes sense financially. But in terms of activating autonomy, we actually have to invert that model. Now, cars are fun and interesting. Everyone drives them. Most autonomous systems will be much more humble. And I've been doing quite a bit of work lately thinking about autonomous bins, because autonomy is mostly going to be small scale. I'm going to want a bin that's going to be able to roll itself to the curb on bin night, so I kind of don't have to think about it. Maybe roll itself off to the car wash when it's a bit dirty. Don't know. But we're going to need all of the systems that support these kinds of devices and another galaxy of devices as well. One of my colleagues sent me a video this morning of an autonomous refrigerator that was rolling itself around the house. She was horrified. She's like, why would a refrigerator want to do this? So it could follow you around, obviously, so you can always have a cold beer at hand. It does seem a little bit excessive, but we need to get this idea that autonomy is not just associated with big things. Autonomy is actually something that is a quality that's going to be applied broadly across everything in the material world, whether it has wheels or not. It might just have a thermostat. Who knows what it's going to be? But autonomy is a quality, and we need to start thinking in those terms when we start to think about how networks will need to be able to respond to autonomy. The other thing we think about, because of the nature of the word autonomy, we think autonomous systems act on their own. We need to change our thinking, because in fact the reverse of that is true. This is this beautiful little system that Honda has created, which basically puts a sensor at an intersection so a car, when it's approaching the intersection, can tell whether a car is approaching from a blind angle on the intersection. So what you have now is autonomy that's being assisted by its interaction with other network systems in the environment. So autonomy is not a singular thing. You don't get autonomy by standing on your own. You get autonomy by linking, by networking, by connecting to as many other possible devices in the environment as you can. This is the great advantage that an autonomous system has over a human being. A human being can rely on their intelligence and on their senses, and that's all very good. An autonomous system can link into broad sensor networks and draw its decision-making from those broad sensor networks. And this is the real future of autonomy. The future of autonomy is a network future, not because it's a 5G car sending a lot of data back to base about something, but because that car is a data vacuum. That bin is a data vacuum, drawing in all of this information so that it can make its own decisions. Now, I want to give you a thinking framework for where we're going with respect to autonomous systems. And this thinking framework comes from Dr. Genevieve Bell at the Australia National University, where she's founded the 3A Institute. And the 3A's stand for autonomy, agency, and assurance. Let's go through these. So autonomy, my bin can roll itself up to the curb, my car can drive itself on the highway. That's autonomy. It has a capacity to do things on its own. Agency is when my bin says, I think it's time to go off for a wash. Or when my car says, I think I'm going to go for a drive by myself. It's when these things can act on their own through some set of decisions, maybe through some set of sensor relationships, but they have this capacity to come up with what they're going to do on their own without intervention. Okay, those two things, they seem like we can do autonomy, agency, we're getting to assurance. How do I know that when my bin is rolling itself up on the curb, it's not going to hit a kid on a bicycle and knock them over, or roll itself out onto the street and cause a car crash? How do I know that my self-driving car isn't going to plow into a tree? How do I know that these devices that we've granted autonomy and agency to perform as designed, perform to expectation? The whole point of the 3AI Institute is that there is a glaring hole in our engineering practice specifically around this last point. We are more or less in our design of autonomous systems where we were in our design of, say, engineering, physical engineering systems at around 1850, where we vaguely knew how to build bridges that wouldn't fall down, but we didn't always get that right. And now, actually, we can get it always right because we have sound engineering practice, which gives us assurance that our physical systems will do what they're supposed to. Well, we can't do that with our autonomous systems yet. We can't do that with agency around these. And so a big part of what we're going to focus on and a big part of where the burden will rest with you is around agency. Let me give you an example of what we're talking about. Everyone loves drones, perhaps a little bit too much. I pulled all of these out of a single week news reporting because drones are showing up all sorts of places they shouldn't be. And yeah, I know the Civil Aviation Authority is the right place to go and complain about this. Except these drones are going where they shouldn't because essentially they have no awareness of where they can go and where they can't go. Now, to some degree, drones have firmware built into them that keep you from flying a drone over an airport runway, which is good. We actually do need that. It's a very, very important thing. But there's a lot of other conditions which are inappropriate or wrong or are privacy violations, and we're working on legislative frameworks for this, but the drones themselves, they don't have any awareness of this. They don't have any broader context that they're operating in. In other words, they don't have any assurance that they're doing the right thing because they have no way to be able to connect to a network to tell. And this is exactly where my own research is being focused right now, is building the systems that allow devices that are autonomous to be able to make inquiries into the environment to get them guidance information, to find out whether they're doing things right or wrong. So if you're trying to fly a drone at the Statue of Liberty, the drone itself would be able to discover for itself that it isn't allowed to do that and it would simply land. Because that's the kind of capacity we need to be able to give these systems. And you have to note that all of that capacity was being delivered over a network, which was using spectrum, probably a 5G network. And so you can now see that, in fact, the ways we're going to be using 5G networks for autonomous systems become very rich and very dense and also now become key drivers of assurance in the 21st century. And 5G is great, don't get me wrong. 5G is absolutely wonderful, but as Narita said, don't put all your eggs in this basket. Because there's more things in heaven and earth than are in the 5G band. One of the big things that's coming along is 802.11ah. You all know about this. This is the next generation of Wi-Fi. It uses the 900 megahertz band, so it goes about a kilometer. This is coming sort of over the next 18 months. You know who the world leaders are in 802.11ah? Us. Morse Micro, which is a CSIRO, Main Sequence Ventures founded startup, are the world leaders in making the silicon chips that will be used everywhere in 802.11ah devices. So we have an inside track on this. This is going to be very important, particularly in industrial applications, because you can use 811AH to get broad coverage inside of a building very inexpensively. So if you're doing industrial and home applications, this is the kind of application for which 802.11ah is much better than 5G, much better than existing Wi-Fi. So we now have an inside track to be setting the standard globally for this intermediate zone, which is going to be really important for autonomous systems, particularly when they're functioning on this modest scale, particularly when it's the bin that's outside the house. These kinds of systems are going to be enabled in a fundamental way by 802.11ah. And there's going to be a range of them. We have to think about the way we're using spectrum as a mix. The future is not binaries. It's not all 5G or all 802.11ah or all this or all that. It's going to be a very rich mixture. And so the successful products, the successful designs, the successful strategies in the future will use multiple techniques, not just because it's going to be money-saving, but because it provides a level of assurance with respect to the network. This is where I really want to leave you with some very important questions about what your work is doing, because networks are absolutely essential to supporting autonomy, to supporting agency, and to providing assurance. An autonomous device without a network is a potentially dangerous device. And the more that we get into the 21st century, the more obvious that is going to become, and the more burden is going to be placed on you to be able to guarantee that when autonomous systems are networked in the broader environment, they are going to have the kind of uptime they need that people can guarantee that they're not going to go rogue. And so at some level, what does that mean? It means you're going to be able to guarantee connectivity, but you're also probably going to be able to guarantee latency, a certain level of bandwidth. You're going to need error recovery. You're going to need to have fallback. And again, this is where that multiple strategy becomes absolutely important, because unless you're using multiple kinds of physical layers, you don't actually have a fallback strategy. I'm starting to be amazed now at the number of ads I see on the telly for get your NBN modem because we've included a 4G SIM in it because your NBN isn't very reliable and we're going to need the 4G SIM. Which is good, though. It's fallback, but it's also telling us something about network reliability. And discovery. How can autonomous systems discover the services that they need in order to be able to support the kinds of decisions that they need to make to operate with assurance in the environment? And again, this is very much a focus of my work because I don't see a lot of that going on yet. And then application support. What kinds of applications can the network be providing to help support all of the autonomous systems that are being attached to them? Because this is the area where a carrier doesn't become a commodity. This is the area where devices will preferentially connect to one network over another because the kinds of applications that are being supported on that network provide greater assurance to those autonomous systems. And those autonomous systems will probably pay for that privilege. So there you go, twin drivers. We have this amazing, very human driver into better fidelity, more reality, more immersion in a very rich, three-dimensional, videogrammetry-driven environment that will overwhelm what we think of as television broadcasting today over the next 500 million seconds, over the next 15 years. That's one side. And then on the other side, you have the machines that will be clamoring for as much consistency and low latency and error recovery and fallback as possible so that they can do the best job that they can and that we can have a sense of assurance that they will be doing that. Thank you very much.